Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 336th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I am a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
And I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and a professor at the University of Alberta.
Guidelines, my friend.
Guidelines, James. You can't get enough of them.
No, which is, and in fact, that's, isn't that why you went away to get away from them? Because you're just back from
Asia.
A very cool trip.
Asia. Yeah, traveling in Asia and eating street food and proving once again that Imodium is a very effective drug.
Good. Nice to know.
Thought I'd share.
Exactly.
Actually, nothing like that happened. It was an amazing trip.
Oh, cool.
And for those of you who haven't been, Asia's a big place.
So I'm sure it's big, but like, do they have a lot of guidelines?
If you ever try to cross the street there, you'll know there's not enough.
It's just kind of random.
Yeah. It's a lot of free form action.
So in other words, not based on any evidence whatsoever, which is kind of like our guidelines.
Yes, that's right.
That's a pretty good segue.
Oh, yeah, sure. It wasn't forced at all.
No. So for those of you who have been following along, and we interrupted our sort of process of looking at guidelines with a Santa Claus podcast, but we've been talking about guidelines. The first podcast we did on that, we talked about how guidelines are graded and all that sort of process and where they come from and so on. And then the second podcast, we talked about who writes the guidelines and if they mention values and preferences. And we would encourage you guys to go back and listen to those. And now we're going to just sort of finish off the discussion by talking a little bit, I guess, Mike, if you would, about sort of why we need guidelines. Even though we've gone over that, we're going to talk about how well people know sort of evidence. How does that sound?
Yeah, sure.
You know, because... You know, there's been a lot of research that's actually looked at how well do, patients and clinicians appreciate how beneficial something is or how harmful it is. And some colleagues that I know of in Australia when I was doing my sabbatical, Tammy Hoffman and Chris Del Mar did a systematic review of patients' expectations of the benefits and harms of treatment, screening, and tests. And... You know, it's a very long article and very well done. And they found that when it comes to benefit, when you look at people who review this sort of information about patients, 88% of the study authors concluded that participants overestimated benefits. And that was for a variety of things, whether it be for cardiovascular disease, screening for prevention of cancer, and so on. And on average, about 67% of these reports patients underestimated harm. And I think that's something that we see fairly consistently, eh, Mike?
Yeah, I think this is an example. We don't understand risk well. And I would say we're talking about patients here, but it's also true of clinicians. And,
right.
And if you think about it for a minute, for anyone who's been in practice, you ask a patient, how long have you had this? And they respond, sometime now, or for a while, or those kind of things. And we know as clinicians, those kind of phrases aren't helpful. We don't know what that means. And if you do ask them to clarify, and occasionally you get a clear answer like 2 weeks, I guess, or 3 months, for the term a while, it can be vastly different patient to patient. The same is true when you say low risk or what have you. Mm-hmm. And then when we extrapolate to me telling you that we're going to screen for cancer and it'll help prevent cancer, what does that mean to you? Does it mean... If we screen 1,000 people like you, we'll prevent one person from dying of cancer in the next 10 years? Probably not. They couldn't, most people wouldn't know that. And probably a fair number of clinicians couldn't pull that number out of the air.
Go ahead,
James. No, I was just going to say that's the number for a lot of our screening. And so I think most people would think the benefits were better and therefore would overestimate them, and they would underestimate the harms that come with screening. And I think this just, I mean, it's good research because it verifies what we thought we knew.
No, exactly. And I think, you know, what's, you know, interesting is that exactly as you said, when you actually ask healthcare providers, they have similar issues. And on average, although it varies depending on what you look at, one of the reports that I've seen from this came out of JAMA in 2016, and this was just a single survey where they asked residents and attending internal medicine physicians to make an estimate of benefit for a variety of things, whether it be, you know, using aspirin for risk factors, warfarin for AFib, or hip fracture reduction with various medications. And about 79% of those people overestimated the benefit. And what was interesting in this one report, 66% overestimated the harm associated with those sorts of things. And a lot of that had to do with things like screening or biopsies, and overestimated right. the risk of bleeding from warfarin.
Yeah, for sure. I think most, if you look at clinicians, they're more likely to think of the harms of these things, because mm-hmm. that's what they worry about. And if you think about it from a clinician's perspective, I did that to the patient. And therefore, right. when harm occurs, it has a much more profound effect, because right. you don't really see the benefit most right. of the time.
You don't
see if someone avoided a stroke from warfarin, but you sure do see when they get a bleed from it and end up with the terrible hematoma or internal hemorrhage or something like that. So they're very profound for us, and I think that's why we, if anything, overestimate the harms.
Interestingly, the group that I just mentioned that did the stuff on patients' expectations of the benefits, they just published a systematic review of clinicians' expectations of the benefits and harms of treatments, screening, and tests, and so on. And they looked at a whole bunch of studies that have looked at this, and they sort of split it up into benefits and harms. And then what they did, and it's kind of a tricky way to kind of think about it, but they identified by what did most clinicians do? And by most, they said 50% of clinicians, were they able to make a correct estimate, overestimate, or underestimate it? And they found that when you're looking at a threshold of could most clinicians do it, so greater than 50%, they found from a benefit perspective, only 11% of the reports that they looked at could more than 50% of clinicians come up with the correct estimate. I know it's kind of a weird way of looking at it. And then they found that 32% of these reports, more than 50% of clinicians overestimated the potential benefit. So you can just see from that perspective, again, it's very similar to what patients do, is that they overestimate the benefit. And then when they looked at harm, interestingly, in this study, they looked at, there's about 26 studies of this, looking at 69 different outcomes, and then looking at how well clinicians were able to do it. And again, the correct estimate was only about 13% of the reports that they talked about. And they, in this case, underestimated harm. About 34% of the reports showed that clinicians underestimated harm. So we're just not very good at doing that. And that's why we think guidelines need to help people do that. And that's kind of why we're talking about this.
Right. And we should provide, instead of saying just simply do this, we should provide them with some information about why they should do it and some of the numbers around that.
Yeah, no, exactly.
It's not that difficult, but it, and I think I mentioned this on some of the last podcasts, when you're on guideline groups, it is surprising how many of the guideline members are resistant to put in absolute numbers. They just don't want to do it. And they give all sorts of excuses, some with pseudo evidence reasons. Well, we're not sure that for individual patients, blah, blah, blah. Some of it's because they don't think it's going to be adopted then, and all sorts of things like that. But it's fascinating. The resistance far exceeds the interest in doing it.
Yeah. And what I find very interesting is that they have no problem in putting in terms like low, medium, and high risk.
Or strongly recommend.
Yeah.
Yeah, like anything like that, but not to actually say there's a 3% reduction in mortality over 6 years. Mm-hmm. They're not going to say that.
No. And I can kind of understand why they wouldn't want to hang their hat on a number, but could they at least just use a range, you know, ballpark?
No, it's one of the arguments that I've heard is they're deeply concerned about the precision of the estimate and its reliability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So can we really say it was only 5% or it will be as good as 5% or should, you know, what about 5.5? It's fascinating. And they don't understand that for me anyway, that doesn't matter as long as we can give a ballpark idea to mm-hmm. people, right? Yeah. We're not talking about a 50% absolute reduction. We're talking about a 3%.
Yeah. And even if you looked at one of the most studied drugs in the world, the statins. Even now, with all the studies that have been done, there's still a reasonable confidence interval around those results. So it's not like we know the exact number.
We never
will.
Ever will.
Yeah.
So why do we worry about it? But to tell them it's 25% relative, up to maybe 35% relative in high doses, and that, you know, if your baseline risk is this, it translates to about this. Like that, I don't know why that's so offensive.
No, I maybe it's just because you're saying it.
Yeah.
Because you always premise it with, look, dumbasses.
Yeah, it's the maybe it's the tone I use.
Yeah.
Why are you guys so dumb?
I have no idea why I said that.
Just to be.
Yeah, I don't know why that's not well received.
I don't know either.
Yeah, but like I said, we have used the, you know, the terms, like people are comfortable using terms like high and low risk, and for those of you who've listened to any of these podcasts, you know we don't like that. And
you and I both say it.
Well, I try to correct you when you do it, and when I say high risk, I will say something like, and by that I mean this.
Oh yeah, you're perfect.
I am perfect. Yeah, I do it all the time. Yeah. And it's only because, you know, many people have looked at this, and we actually looked at this many, many years ago, where we asked clinicians and patients, you know, what is high risk? And, you know, the most common response that we saw when we said, what would you say if you said a person was at a high risk of a heart attack, what would that mean the person's chance of a heart attack was in the next 5 years? And the most common response was somewhere between 11 and 20%. Which actually is kind of what many guidelines think of as kind of moderate to high risk. It's tricky, but there was it went all the way from 1 to 100. So when a clinician tells you that you're at high risk, that means your risk is somewhere between 1% and 100%.
Okay.
Which is, I may be wrong. I don't think that's that helpful.
No, and I'm not sure about the arguments around precision again.
Yes. But then when you ask patients the exact same question, they're sort of the most common response to high risk is between 40 and 50%. And that's a 5-year risk, which almost nobody is ever at.
Yeah. I was just thinking how you could get there. If you had a number of MIs and then picked up smoking and got diabetes.
Yeah.
And refuse to take every medicine available.
Yeah, yeah, and you might get there.
You might get there. Yeah. If you worked hard at it.
But then some people, when you tell them they're at high risk, they say, "Well, it's probably between 76% and 100%." And that's just, wouldn't that be sad if that's what your patients come across? If you tell them high risk, they're thinking, you know, why even leave the office?
Mike Kolber would say, never buy green bananas because you're not going to be alive long enough for them to ripen.
Oh, there that. We've got to do a podcast on empathy. But anyway, there's also been lots of other evaluations. There was one from the BMJ in 2003, and we've got all these references in our handout for this podcast, where when you actually engage in patients and clinicians and ask them, would you take a medication for this sort of thing? They actually, their preferences are almost always at odds with what would be typically recommended in guidelines. And we've seen that for cardiovascular disease. And there's also studies for things like for osteoporosis and fracture reduction. And actually, when you ask people to give you the numbers, you would have to have, the medications would have to be so much better than they are for many people to consider them.
Yeah, we'd have to be at much higher risk often, and the medicines would have to be. There's one study that looked at when do patients, regular clinicians, and then guideline experts think that patients should initiate therapy for osteoporosis and your hip fracture risk. And for patients, they thought it should be 50% absolute risk. For clinicians, they thought it should be 10% absolute risk of a hip fracture. And for guideline experts, they thought it should be 3%.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this incredible discordance in what kind of risk level we should be at before we initiate therapy. Then on top of it, you have to account for the kind of things you were talking about. What's the actual benefit of therapy?
And then, so all of that is are issues that are associated with, do we, you know, that even with the therapy working, people may not take the treatment. And that assumes that everything works. And as we've talked about this many times before, you know, up until just about a year or so ago, we had a lot of negative studies on risk reduction for lipids and blood pressure and so on. There's been a few, and we've talked about almost every one of them, I think, that's come out recently, showing at least it didn't increase death and cardiovascular outcomes. But it's not, you know, these effects are not consistent. So even if they were consistent, a lot of people wouldn't take them. And then we're sort of not always making it up, but we're sometimes exaggerating that the effect is consistent.
Yeah, well, there's virtually no consistency. Yeah. I guess there's 2 out of 3 trials for the GLP-1s that were positive. Mm-hmm. And that's gold.
Yeah, I know.
You're looking at diabetes. Yeah. That is pure gold.
But it's only pure gold because everything else is kind of lead.
Yeah, it's not good. The DPP-4s, man, just a signal of benefit from them would be good. But anyway, we digress. Yeah, there's been a lot of negative studies.
Yeah, and you know, the same. And again, looking at the notes that you can go look at on our site, there's also data on with cancer studies and cancer patients, and they're showing that the number of patients who want to participate in this sort of process is increasing, and in fact, the majority of patients. And I don't think when I say a majority, I actually, and you know, I don't mean this anywhere close to 100%. But when I say the majority, I would say nowadays over 50% of patients do want to participate in most decisions. If you had to make a, you know, it's not so much as it used to be where they'd say just, you know, tell me what to do or whatever you say, doctor. That still happens quite a bit though, right, Mike?
Yeah. Oh, for sure it does. Yeah. For sure it does. And I've had to. You know, it's very hard to get people to decide on adrenaline during an anaphylactic shock. That's my biggest problem, is that that conversation seems very stilted to me.
Yeah.
I get nothing from you.
This is my gold stuff.
This is the gems, and you're... These are the jokes, people. Come on.
this podcast is a joke. So speaking about jokes, lawyers...
So any jokes?
Yeah. So we've talked a lot about, you know, guidelines, shared decision making, and so on and so forth. And you know, Mike, you and I have done presentations on, you know, almost ad nauseum. And what's the one question that always comes up?
Won't I get sued if I don't follow the guidelines?
Exactly. It's constant. Mm-hmm. And we've looked at this a lot, and it's really interesting. And I'll ask you, are you aware of any, have you ever heard of any of your colleagues ever being sued for this?
No, not that I know of.
None that I know of. I've read a case about it in the New England Journal of Medicine a number of years ago. I've never heard of anyone even being, and I don't even mean successfully sued.
Yeah, I don't know of anybody. I'm sure there are.
Like, I'm sure there are too.
There's someone out there who has, at least someone who's been, part of the reason that they were taken to court, or at least written down, or had to answer some college response to the college, was based on did they follow the recommended rules, I'm sure there's that out there.
Yeah, but it's not an overwhelming number of things, because you get sued successfully primarily for being negligent.
Are you talking me specifically, or
yes, you specifically? Yeah, the times when you've been negligent.
You know, that's a little close to home.
I know.
I think it's and one of the things that's held against you is not per se whether you were following the guidelines, but were you following what the majority of your colleagues would do in a similar case?
Yeah. No, for sure. And so there's a few things that I've been able to find when you look up sort of the evidence, and I'm really, again, using that with air quotes around this thing. So there's a couple of things that I thought people might find interesting. In one of the most recent Canadian Journal of Diabetes guidelines that came out of the Canadian Journal of Diabetes guidelines, that in bold letters at the beginning of it, it says this: as per the Canadian Medical Association handbook on clinical practice guidelines should not be used as a legal resource in malpractice cases, as their more general nature renders them insensitive to the particular circumstances of the individual cases, which I think is a really appropriate thing to say within a guideline. And obviously they felt it necessary to say that because of this issue, right?
I think so. And it is impressive that they would include that.
Yeah. Now, what is not impressive is the rest of that guideline. But that doesn't matter. They at least said this.
Okay.
I think I'm in trouble now.
One thing.
Yeah.
200 pages. They got this right.
They nailed that part. And then there's been the Canadian Medical Protective Association has chimed up on this. And this is from September 2011. And they said things like, even an authoritative CPG may not be found to be determinant of a standard of care. And what they say is that it is prudent for physicians to be aware of these guidelines. And if a clinical decision may be perceived as going against that guideline, a physician, where appropriate, may consider the following steps: consult with a colleague or relevant specialist, discuss reasonable treatment options with the patient, and document the patient's consent for the chosen treatment. And again, I think that's a very reasonable thing to do. So you don't have to follow them. You have to be aware of them, and you have had to have had that conversation. And I think it's fairly common sense, right?
And I think most of our in Canada, it's the CMPA, but groups that are involved in defense of physicians in practice, they would argue that documentation is one of the key components of any of these cases.
Yeah, no, so exactly. And we've had a number of these guys come to our course and say exactly the same thing. And in JAMA in 2016, there was an article written specifically about this. And they were talking about some fairly recent court cases that have come out from a malpractice perspective. And apparently they're fairly similar in the UK, the US, and Canada, and so on. And this is the standard that it appears that people are now going to be held to. I mean, obviously these things take a while, but they said the reasonable patient standard is now it requires physicians and other healthcare practitioners to disclose all relevant information about the risks, benefits, and alternatives of a proposed treatment that an objective patient would find material in making an intelligent decision as to whether to agree to the proposed procedure. And I think that's, even though it's somewhat vague, I think it's as good as one could write a statement about that.
Yeah. And it has to do a lot with the individuality of each case, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, so, you know, we spend a lot of time sort of beating up on guidelines and trying to show some of the issues with it. So why don't we sort of wrap up a little bit about some of the issues? So I think you'd agree, Mike, there are a lot of guidelines out there.
Yeah. More than a couple.
Yeah. And we talked about that earlier on. I hope we've convinced you that they often don't provide a solid synopsis or a systematic review of the best available evidence, which I always find quite surprising because every guideline for guidelines says to do that.
And most guidelines that don't do that will still include a statement somewhere that they're evidence-based.
Yeah.
The term evidence-based means almost nothing. And in fact, and I'm not going to get how you say his name right, John Ioannidis, I think.
Yeah, I think it's Ioannidis.
Ioannidis, he's just written on, you know, how evidence-based medicine has been kind of tainted over the years to what it was really intended to do.
Exactly.
And it just speaks to that we use that term very, very loosely. And in fact, you and I have both had conversations with our colleagues who define evidence-based medicine as guidelines.
Don't get me started.
Okay.
And I think hopefully we've shown you guys that they often don't provide sufficient information to do shared decision making or even actually support the concept. There are many conflicts and ownership issues that are associated with it. And as we've just talked about recently, their patient expectations are often at odds with the guideline recommendations. And we've very recently just mentioned that legal precedents are leaning in favor of benefit, harm, and communication. And so I think, you know, as a healthcare provider, you obviously, you know, we need to know that there are these guidelines out there. And I think when it comes to things like education about this, and the reason that we do these podcasts, is I think it's really important because you know as well as I do, Mike, when you teach very junior people, they hang on to these guidelines as if they were, you know, a statement.
The Ten.
Yeah, coming down, you know, one of the Ten Commandments.
Exactly. Exactly. And I understand that. Right?
I totally
You're
get
just
it, yeah.
learning. And so you want to know the truth.
Mm-hmm.
You want to know, so this is what I need to know. This is the truth. And you don't really want to know the, you know, 80 metric tons of information and knowledge that went into that. You just want the bottom line kind of thing. And mm-hmm. I totally get that. But unfortunately, so much is lost in the guidelines that and there's just for all the reasons you listed that I think as you mature as a clinician, you begin to recognize that that kind of approach doesn't really suit application to patients very well.
Yeah. And you know, I don't think we're suggesting completely anyway that, you know, if you did just nothing but follow guidelines, that your care is going to be atrocious. I don't think we're saying that at all.
No, I just think it limits you. It sometimes limits you from being the clinician I think that we should be, right?
Mm-hmm.
The nuance of patients that, you know, Mrs. Jones is now on three powerful antihypertensives at full dose because she has some heart failure and she's falling down and she's complaining about her day, like her day is no longer any fun, et cetera, mm-hmm. because she's so dizzy all the time. That I think we need to feel comfortable to consider the patient's wishes and all of those kind of mm-hmm. things, where in many, many clinicians don't. They
yeah.
feel obliged to follow these rules without actually considering the other consequences of them.
Yeah. And so I totally agree. And I think you said it very, very well, my friend.
Thanks.
And, and enough of that. And the reason we do these podcasts and why we teach this stuff is to sort of, I think as we teach about guidelines or talk about guidelines, we really need to let people know about the limitations and the issues associated with them. And it's why we push and promote the concepts of being able to individually appraise and integrate the best available evidence, because that is ultimately the way to do it. And unfortunately, it's not guidelines that do that. And you know, we've talked about this in the past. We don't have evidence to answer every question, but I think exactly as you mentioned, Mike, I think if you practice in the way that we're suggesting, I think it makes it more rewarding. It doesn't necessarily make it easier or harder. It just makes, I think, more rewarding for many people. At least that's the feedback we get from a lot of people.
Yeah, I think for the first while, it certainly makes it more challenging because
mm-hmm.
it's this shift of thinking and also feeling like you need to know everything to do that. And of course, you don't. But I think over time, it becomes much more freeing. And actually, I think you become a more rounded clinician because you're
mm-hmm.
actually discussing with patients and talking to them about how they're doing on these medicines rather than strictly just, you know, sorry, we can't deal with your sore ankle today because I have to find out when you were last tested for your A1C, and I don't want to make, I want to make sure that doesn't go beyond 3 months and that, those kind of things.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually it pushes you to find out what they're really worried about and what they want.
Yeah.
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 So I don't know if we have a solution to guidelines, what should they contain? Who should write them and what should they not contain?
We've published that, James.
Oh, I know.
We've written on it. You were, if I'm not mistaken, you were the second author on the article titled "The Future of Guidelines."
Yes. So we're going to get that. It was a premise. I was leading into it.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Segue. Sorry.
They were rhetorical questions. So correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm sure you will. I think guidelines would be awesome if they did this, if they were developed primarily by and definitely for the people that ultimately ended up using them. You would agree with that, I think.
I think that's blasphemous, but yes.
Yes. I think you'd also agree that they would be very excellent if they were a credible synopsis of the best available evidence presented in a way that clinicians could easily access and interpret.
I would agree with that, too. And I think everybody who writes a guideline thinks they've done that.
Oh, I think they do. Yeah.
Yeah.
The evidence somewhat goes against them.
But totally goes against that.
Totally, okay. But that's... okay, I was trying to be nice.
Yeah.
And if they allowed patient values and preferences to be taken into account, which they definitely don't do that.
They ever so rarely get glimpses of that.
Exactly. Yeah. So this is going to be a little bit of self-promotion, and this is primarily Mike's baby, although there was lots of people who helped him out. And we tried to come up with a guideline that is by no means perfect, but we tried to deal with the issues that we complained about. At least that's the way I perceive what we tried to do. What do you think about that, Mike?
Yeah, so we definitely tried to do that. We had an evidence review group, which was handed 10 questions from the guideline committee to look at, and then later on two more. And the evidence review group consisted of family doctors and pharmacists who did primary care. Then we had the actual lipid pathway or lipid guideline group included two specialists in general internists, a nurse practitioner, two pharmacists, a nurse, and four family doctors. So a very different kind of compilation of participants than what we normally see in guidelines. Over 50% are generally specialists, and often not even general specialists. They're subspecialists. And then we had a pathway review group, which was run by Mike Colbert, and that group consisted of mostly. When it was sent out, it consisted mostly of family doctors. There were 32 peer reviewers. We sent out to just under 50, and we got 32 back, and most of them were family doctors, although they were specialists too and from all over the world. And then we had a kind of patient education and implementation group, which you were part of, James.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And that, again, was mainly primary care. So we tried to always focus on primary care. Our evidence review group was very detailed in their assessments, and there's over 100-page document that accompanies that. But that's an adjunctive piece of material that we don't expect anyone but the most hardcore evidence enthusiasts to read, so maybe two people. Mm-hmm. But the guideline itself was around 20 pages, and then it abbreviates down to a simple 2 pages of an algorithm and some stuff around how do you talk to patients and what are the numbers.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the prime comment is, prime information that comes out is, these are your risks. This is, we need to talk to you about that. And we need to talk to you about the potential for benefit and the potential for harm. And ultimately, I mean, one of the statements that we presented was, are statins right for you? And the first line after that was, you decide. And you know, speak with your healthcare provider. So we tried as much as possible to practice what we preach. We obviously didn't perfect it, but I think we and you were able to show that one can do it if one has the desire to do it.
Yeah, and we used the best available evidence that we could, of course, advocating lifestyle first, but we actually, in the kind of one pager back to front, there is what if your patient, we gave relative risks, and then we said, and as an example, if your patient has a 20% risk over 10 years, and then we gave the absolute benefits, the number needed to treat, and the new risk they would get from every primary intervention for cardiovascular risk, not including blood pressure. So smoking cessation, Mediterranean diet, exercise, statins, and ASA. So, you know, and I think that that's quite novel in in any guideline. Yeah, to actually give all the numbers right there for anyone to look at.
Yeah, so. And you know, some of those numbers could change tomorrow with a new study.
Yeah, it's quite possible they could change, although the probability that they'll have a drastic change is low.
Yeah. Yeah, and certainly not for statins, because we got so many of those. We know, you know, as much about those as we maybe not the harm issues are trickier, but you know. Yep. So anyway, we'll put there's links to that guideline. So there are ways to do it. Hopefully, you guys have found this conversation of value, and it sort of reiterates a lot of what we've been talking about over the last, dare I say, 8 years when it comes to. Evidence and guidelines and taking care of patients. So hopefully this has been of value. Anything else you want to add about guidelines, or I'm sick to death of them.
Yeah, we're sick to death of them. But the irony is that we keep getting invited to either participate in them or to be the people who generate them. And I think after all our complaining, we have to either put up or shut up. Yeah. So we're trying to put up. So we are building a team that's going to hopefully generate more of these rational guidelines. There's certainly an interest in that. Interestingly, not just in Alberta or BC, but across Canada, and also even, as you know, our guideline, James, was mentioned in the BMJ and other sources as a kind of different approach to looking at guidelines, and we've got support. So we're going to be pressing ahead, even though it is, each one is a huge undertaking in itself.
Yeah. No, but they're fun contextually to do.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So I think we'll leave it at that. There's not a bunch more that we need to add in. And as always, we would love it if you'd leave comments on iTunes. I've asked a few times in the last number of podcasts, and very few of you are doing it. So if you've got nothing else better to do, you could drop a few nice comments about us on iTunes. You could go check out our website and look at all of the stuff that we do. And we've just completely updated the look and feel of our website. We're going to start working on a little bit more content as well, but it's going to look a little bit different, and hopefully it works well. If not, let us know and we can make some changes. Our Best Science Medicine annual course is coming up April 7-8, and we're going to getting people to be able to sign up for it, so we would love it if you would attend. Anything else, Mike?
No, I think that's it, James.
Cool. So, as always, thanks for listening.
Talk to you later.